that, you know, and understanding the relationship of themselves to their own community and extending that relationship to, you know, the greater ecosystem that our capitalist system is destroying.
And do we have a female voice to respond in that as well?
I believe that we are surrounded by brilliant, brilliant people. I'm from Oakland, and I've been here for a year and a half, and my experience in New York has been very up and down. But being here, surrounded by these minds, these thoughts, I really had an epiphany probably about a week and a half ago in a meeting, thinking, I think I'm going to be surrounded by the people who are leading, who are going to be future leaders, or who are, like you said, Luke, are empowering themselves through these things that they probably thought they never had a chance to do. Like, I'm seeing people come from situations where they thought they had nothing at all. They had nothing to live for. And now I'm coming here finding something to die for. And that speaks alone in itself.
I mean, wow. And Madame?
You know, the same. This goes hand in hand with the non-demand, and I think a lot of people have heard and hear us say over and over again that we're a leaderless movement, and that doesn't mean that people don't take leadership or empower themselves in the ways that Luke was talking about. And if you think about, if we're talking about tomorrow or down the road or whenever that's going to be, you know, these are things that we're grappling with now, and they're not perfect, and they're not even really working per se, being leaderless. It's really hard. You know, that's something we're all finding out. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to, and that's not to say that the right combination and the right set of, like, ideologies can't come together and make it work. And so right now it's kind of just fitting the pieces in the puzzle. But, you know, I'm also of the firm belief that we won't be the leaders of tomorrow. We'll all be the leaders of tomorrow.
I mean, I personally think that the state of the world and the state of the nation is what brought this movement forth. And one of the basis principles of this movement I've found is care. You know, in the world today, there's such a lack of care. You know, corporations don't care that they're polluting the earth, polluting waters, have policies, and the government has policies that are destroying families, people's lives. And one thing that this collective at Liberty Park has is, to me, it was a coming together of people that wanted to create change. To me, that's a unifying factor between all of us, a common ground. And one thing in the community that's developed is its basis is on the premise of care and love. And we're bringing, to me, it's like the resurrection of care and brotherhood. Like, it's the world supporting us and us supporting each other. And I think that needs to extend into the policies of the future. We need to care about our earth. We need to care about our brothers and sisters. And I believe the founding or foundation and principles for the future should be based on an understanding of the need for equilibrium with all life and a balance with and care for, like, yeah, just like all life, be it human or plant or water or animal. You know, and that's what I see that we're creating is like care and love.
All right. One other thing.
Future.
Yeah. One other thing about leadership to throw in, I think pretty much all of us are very tired of the top-down politics of being ordered around and that kind of thing. And the reason that a non-hierarchical action appeals to us is that the only kind of leadership that we seem to find attractive is just like coaching people and showing them cool ways to do things. And then if they want to do that, they can. Not top-down leadership, but trying to only just lead by example and trying to coach people to unlock their own full potential.
Yeah, you know, there's some people in this room I probably wouldn't mind following. But really, I don't want to see us become leaders. Personally, I don't want to see myself as a leader. But I'd rather see this movement help people empower themselves and take more responsibility for their own actions. I think that's been one of the amazing things that's gone down at Zuccotti Park.
And we're coming up on a station break. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. This is Occupy Wall Street Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Humans make mistakes. Accidents happen. It's always been that way. It's no different with fracking. No matter how many safety measures are put in place, blowing up bedrock, injecting toxic chemicals, and sucking the hazardous waste back to the surface is dangerous work, and accidents will happen. But fracking companies are exempt from the federal laws designed to protect citizens and keep air and water clean. Unless Governor Cuomo stands up to the oil and gas industry, high-volume, high-pressure, horizontal slickwater hydrofracking is coming to New York State. It's a risk-benefit thing. We take the risk, fracking companies get the benefit. If this sounds wrong to you, take a minute and tell Governor Cuomo to do the right thing by saying no to fracking in New York. This message is brought to you by WBAI and the producers of Green Street. Join us at 1millionfrackingletters.com.
This is Cornel West, and for the best in rhythm and blues, reggae, ska, calypso, and all the musical cultures in the rich African diaspora, I listen to the Midnight Ravers on alternate Fridays over listener-sponsored non-commercial radio WBAI 99.5 FM. The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special show.
This is Harvey Pekar, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported radio in New York. Is that okay? What, do you want me to do a bunch of them?
Yeah. Sounds all we need is a spark. Set it off.
I take money from the rich and invest it in the poor. Been a long time coming, time we settle the score. You can do it for your people, but I do it for your all. And yes, I got mines, love it, and I never let them fall. When the real hits the fan, son, who you gonna call? Not Ron Paul, more like the Honor of Paul. River Martinez with a team of superheroes. Walk throughout the land for my team of super zeros. Add it up, come back with negative indictments of a system that stomped out positive enlightenment. Occupy the streets, let's occupy the nation. But don't occupy your mind with false occupation. Occupy the positions when your team falls short. Stand with the accused by occupying the court. Occupy all airwaves and spaces in between. Occupy the undercover and the overseen. But when occupying ain't enough, and we need a next tactic. Combine the global block map and see what happens. We do it for the people, we do it for the movement. Occupy America, that's what we do.
Occupation, that's what they all yelling. But it's gangsta nation. Our bank is definitely selling our future.
Occupy, that's what we're doing. Welcome back. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. My name is Tony Bates. I'm in the building with too many people to enumerate. We don't have that much time. We have Luke, we have Sade, we have Victoria, we have Max, we have Dan and Daniel, and we have Faith. All of them are connected to Occupy Wall Street Radio, a brand new program here on WBAI, which will be heard Monday through Friday from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Now, something that we haven't covered yet, there has been, we touched on slightly, but there has been, since you've been camped in the park, a heavy police presence. I've seen it grow. In fact, I thought one night that I spoke to a cop, an undercover cop, and made them, which caused them to surround the park with barricades. They had one part of the, one side of the park only. I may or may not have said something to an undercover police officer, which made them barricade the lot, and I don't want to admit to that.
Tony.
But I know. It was the night you guys were marching on Wall Street and had to run, the night you had to run through buildings and this, that, and the other, Victoria. You remember that night?
Security culture.
Security culture. So let's talk about the police presence there, and what has your experience been like with police?
I mean, I think it's useful to start from the beginning.
Okay. Let's.
You know, I think, and I know Luke was there, and I know Max, you were there kind of in the beginning too, and Dan, you were there remotely watching us. And I think that first week up until a lot of us got arrested at Union, south of Union Square, there was a very different police presence than there is now. And that is to say that it was a much more visual thing. They were there constantly. They were patrolling. They were in the park. They were
threatening.
Threatening and engaging and kind of violating privacy, I guess. It's like it's a public-private space. But, you know, if you think about the way they are now, which I don't know if anyone wants to hop in on how it is now, but it's kind of hall monitor style now.
The contrast is as extreme as this. In the beginning, they were basically linked arm in arm, ringing the park, standing over us, 100 feet tall, each of them glaring down at us like some kind of hall monitor of doom. And now you see, now it's much more substitute teacher style, where they don't seem to be able to bring it quite as forthright and earnestly as they did in the old days. But back on the first night, we thought we were going to get swept out of the park by street cleaners any second. We thought we were going to get beaten down in our sleep. I thought I was going to get rolled and tear gassed while my eyes were closed.
But much like they're doing in Oakland right now.
Yeah. But we had that first week, there was a lot of rain and there was a lot of, you know, trial and error on our part trying to get things together, and the police presence and their interference was, again, very different than it is now. We've got tents and we've got structures. That first week, I think we did the tent thing very briefly. That got shut down, and that was how we found the people who were going to be our legal aid, which was the first stand. And then the second stand was the rain the next night again, and set up tarps, lots of tarps everywhere, covering the food, covering people's belongings, and covering the media equipment. And I remember waking up to a tarp in my face, and actually I was with Luke and our friend Spike. That was a police call, and that was before we had really, as a group, decided how we would deal with that when the police came in and demanded of the occupiers that we need to do something. And I think the consensus amongst the group was that if that was the case, then the police were to do that themselves. But, you know, saying that and having people do it is two different things. So I woke up to an occupier cutting our tarp down in our face, saying that the police had instructed him to do it. I think a number of people got arrested in that incident for peacefully protesting that action.
So when you're talking about this, I think it's very important to note the seeming randomness of the enforcement.
Extremely.
And the violence in which the enforcement was taken out. There were people who were arrested for holding tarps over expensive video equipment, who were thrown down, dragged out of the park, stepped on, and put in the zip-tie handcuffs that we've all found out are way too tight. There was someone who was arrested for speaking on a megaphone, or one of the bullhorns, because amplified sound isn't allowed. And this was all before we really understood what laws really applied to us, and which ones didn't. There were a lot of people who were taken from our marches, just snatched, because they were wearing facial coverings.
Bingo.
For whatever that reason may be, there are a lot of people who don't want their place of employment knowing that they're on these marches. There's a lot of people who don't, for obvious reasons, don't want to be identified by law enforcement. And these people were snatched from the crowd simply for choosing to act anonymously. And there's been, you know, very violent, swift, and in the beginning, seemingly random enforcement of the statutes regarding, you know, many, many things in this private public space that we occupy.
And, you know, the way we dealt with it was hit on earlier, but again, it's different now, but we really tried to get the live stream out there, people with cameras, people with video cameras and still photography, anyone's cell phones, a lot of cell phones out. And that was just protocol for us at the time, was if a white shirt, which is an officer higher than the regular ones wearing the blue uniforms, was walking through, there would be five people with cameras behind him, not necessarily saying anything. In fact, most of the time it was just silent, just cameras following police. And that's part of that security culture we're talking about, and that's part of a lot of, I think, prevention of things that could have escalated, or in a lot of times did escalate.
And now, what's the relationship between the Liberty Park and you occupiers and the police currently?
They hang out like an invisible swarm of bees about half a block away,
untamed.
Just out of sight.
Barricades around the park.
Yeah, they have barricades. We're caged in pretty well, so they don't actually need to be observing us professionally. But at a moment's notice, they can all ride upon us and charge us down on steeds of steel or steeds of horse.
With the zip ties,
oh yeah.
Zip ties are there.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, there was one particular night where it seemed like that was the biggest mass of police that had showed up at the entire time. And I remember Victoria saying to the live feed, tell everyone, call every extension in the police department, call every extension. And so on the live stream video, we posted the main front police number with extension all. And so people must have probably reined into the police department thousands of calls down to every extension. And I really think that psychologically that may have made the difference because, you know, as people pointed out to me, in this city, usually when the police mass up like that, they've always followed through with mass arrests. And that was the last time, that they actually had on-site enough officers to mass arrest everybody. And I think at that point, they psychologically rolled back. And then after that, I think psychologically speaking, the police did not have the same attitude towards the park. And so I think that approaching it at that level and trying to reach through the blue wall, essentially, did actually work in New York City. And now similar things are happening in parallel across the country.
I think that's really interesting to know is that even though we are seeing this kind of alleviation from the police presence that we were familiar with in the beginning, I'm watching, and I work with the live stream a lot, I'm watching it happen almost everywhere else. And I'm watching that same kind of randomness and that same kind of unpredictability or seemingly unpredictable behavior happen in other places. And, you know, to some extent that is, I guess, predictable.
It is to some extent, indeed. I think that we should talk about some of the basic stuff on the ground now, how the camp operates. How did you come up, for instance, with the people's microphone? Was that borrowed? Was that brought to the to Liberty Square?
I don't think we invented the people's microphone. The people's microphone is a method by which the speaker says something kind of in small bits and phrases, and then the entire audience repeats it a bit louder so that people who are standing on the outskirts of the outskirts of the crowd can hear it.
Maybe we should do an example.
Would you like to?
Mic check!
Mic check!
And now someone says something.
And now someone says something.
And now someone says something.
So that's how it works.
Yeah. So that's how it works.
So that's how it works.
You get that's how
it, you have that's how it breaks
various
down.
Generations of mic checks depending on the size of the crowd. So there can be up to about 3 waves. I think at Washington Square Park, there were 5 waves going on, and I heard that was really successful. So.
Accepting the occupation. The people's mic was successful.
That happened the first day, too. I mean, I really distinctly remember that. That was I knew that they had smaller GA sessions at Tompkins, but I don't think that had to be used because those were really small groups of people. I mean, the first day, it's not the numbers we have now, but coming out of that day of rage, there was still a couple hundred in the park, and, you know, the first facilitators were standing and everyone else was seated, kind of clamored around them in concentric circles, waiting to, like, be called on stack. And, you know, given that we couldn't have any amplified sound and given that, like, we were so wary at that first day, like, police were there, and it's like, you don't know what your relationship to them is at all, so that people's mic manifested, and I'm sure someone's had experience with it outside of this occupation, but it really acts functionally and symbolically. You know, we don't need amplified sound.
Well, I think one of the most powerful images of what we're doing here, you know, this people's mic, I can't quite call it an image, but, you know, this really seems to resonate with people, the fact that one person says something and then everyone else repeats it. It shows a bit of unity. It's interesting to note that this came specifically from a police repression tactic, that they weren't going to let us use the bullhorns, they weren't going to let us use amplified sound, and I believe on day 2, Justin Wiedes got arrested for speaking on a bullhorn. And
there's a great picture of that.
Very shortly after, we started employing the people's mic full time.
And I just remember being amazed. I'd been doing video production in Minneapolis for quite a while. I think this was into the second week. And I came outside, and I was heading down to see what was going on for the General Assembly in Minneapolis as they were preparing to start. And I heard people saying, "Mic check," and in my own city. And that was kind of amazing. I was like, wow, this thing is spread into my city. This pattern is here. It's now.
Well, to describe for the audience, please, what the General Assembly is.
So, and again, I'm going to take it from the beginning and someone can hop in, but we started with 2 a day, one at 1 p.m. and one at 7 p.m. And, they were meetings that follow a very specific structure based on consensus and now on modified consensus. And I think it'd be great if one of us hopped in and explained what that meant.
Sure. Someone want to give us an example of consensus versus modified consensus?
Sure. What we're generally used to in this country is a parliamentary procedure in which there are opposing viewpoints and debate, and eventually there is a vote and a winner. What we operate on in the park is a consensus decision-making process, where instead of voting, what we are concerned with are concerns that anyone holds that would keep the proposal from going forward. And then we work as a group to resolve these concerns until we can either amend the proposal or simply alleviate these concerns, approaching and eventually reaching a decision that everyone in the group feels comfortable enacting as a group and taking part in.
So it's proposal, clarifying question, friendly amendment, move for blocks, and if that clears, then a request for consensus. And that's, I mean, that's the general process, but the GA is much larger than that. So there's more than a GA than proposals. There's announcements, there's working group report backs. Those actually sometimes take longer than the rest, I think. But I think maybe we haven't talked about what a working group is.
And the other thing, too, is that different cities are kind of developing their own approaches to this. And so some general assemblies may say, we don't need 100% consensus, we only need 90%. And that's a kind of a very difficult gradient to work out to see what people are comfortable with. But it's important to recognize that there is a diversity of approaches to this. Like, everybody is crafting their own approach.
Can we hit really quickly on how working groups formed?
Absolutely. Tell us, give us the name first of some of the working groups and tell us how that formed, how that came about. Anyone else?
Kitchen, sanitation.
Direct action.
Mm-hmm. Comfort.
Think tank.
Media.
PR.
Zach. I just
arts and culture.
Max, anybody say Zach, say sanitation yet?
Oh, yeah. Someone said sanitation. Oh, okay. Sanitation. The bottom line.
We're speaking with the sanitation overlord here.
The morning that I met Max, he was, in fact, trying to empower people to become involved in sanitation.
I had to empower them with my fists.
Right. He was very not happy about the conditions at the park and the fact that people didn't seem to care about them, but that's changed a bit in recent weeks. But again, let's get back to it. So some of the groups we have Comfort. What is Comfort?
Comfort is bedding and personal hygiene. It's how, like, it's blankets, it's toothbrushes, toothpaste, clothes. Anything.
Clothes. Now, according to the newspapers, you guys don't use any of that stuff.
Sometimes.
You know, when we can find a convenience store or fast food restaurant washroom that we can use their water fountains at, then, yeah, we brush our teeth sometimes.
What is the relationship? How does an occupier interact with Comfort?
Well, I went over there today, and I asked for contact lens solution and socks, and they gave me contact lens solution, but they couldn't give me any clean socks.
He's not explaining that he's got really big feet.
Yeah, I do have big feet. I need large socks.
Dan's very tall. I'm sure they had socks
for those of us who are normal size. He's looking in on the 10th floor. Yep, we have a specially large microphone designed just for him.
Normal size socks they've got.
I want giant socks. No. Yeah, so I just went up and requested that, and they were able to help me out with that. And then also every night, I think at about 8:30, they make bedding available. And so large amounts of bedding have been made available. I believe that, ironically, a huge number of Verizon inflatable beds were provided through a connection to the Verizon Union. They were able to get these, and so they're kind of ironic. But, yeah, they supply this stuff.
So Comfort, just as pretty much any of our social services, as you might call them, operates on a give what you can, take what you need basis. I think that's kind of the foundation of the society that we're building. You know, to everyone according to their needs, from everyone according to their means.
And
nicely said.
Some of the hardest working folks I've seen out there in Liberty Square are the kitchen staff.
Yes.
I won't leave
kitchen.
The sanitation staff
Love
out here.
Kitchen
staff works so hard, and they've recently put in some new regulations where they're closing earlier, but previously I'd see them open at 4 o'clock in the morning. As long as people wanted to eat, they were serving. Let's speak to kitchen, how that part of the the operation functions?
I mean, it's growing. It's growing rapidly. We were all, I think, at some point, or hopefully we've all kind of worked on Kitchen at some point. And, you know, it's like Luke is saying, there's a lot of give and take with donations and how to mediate how much food is going to be needed for a day, how many people are going to be there. How do you anticipate that? It's nearly impossible. So the Kitchen's done a remarkable job kind of coordinating between donations that are perishable, non-perishable, and then having to purchase the balance of those types of meals and then feeding people in the in-between times. So there's a really heavy amount of coordination. Kitchen is kind of the forerunner in most of our infrastructure working groups in terms of, like, getting things done and getting people fed. And, you know, they're working a lot now on that.
Frankly, I think they've done a little too good a job.
Yeah.
they've spoiled this rotten.
And we're dealing with that now. That's something that maybe we'll talk about tomorrow, but we're dealing with that in the present day.
Well, I'm really proud of OWS and so many of the groups that have, like, sprung up. And the Kitchen group is amazing. It's something that, I mean, someone from Egypt called in $300 worth of pizza. People, like, come and drop by food at 5 a.m., 8 a.m., anytime. Like, this little woman brought, like, muffins that she baked. And once again, it's, like, the community supporting our community. And OWS is also able to feed all of the occupiers, plus literally the thousands of people that, you know, walk through to check out what's going on every day and create a variety that we're able to feed people that are vegan, vegetarian,
gluten-free.
Carnivorous, gluten-free. Yeah. So, like, I love the fact that we're trying to cater to everyone and able to do it.
Yeah. The Kitchen staff works incredibly hard. By the way, I was near the Kitchen today and I was told that they needed donations of water, especially in the 5-gallon sizes. So if you can bring water down there, they were certainly requesting that. And probably other donations as well. We're going to switch just a little bit now, folks, and go to a phone call or a guest. Last night in Oakland, or early this morning in Oakland, people went in to occupy Oakland. Not people, the police went in to occupy Oakland and absolutely ransacked the place using the heaviest Gestapo tactics imaginable. Arrested bunches of people. I think they fined them $10,000 each or something of that nature. We have a guest on the phone now. Max, you might introduce our guest. Who was there at the occupation?
This is Lindsay Christofany and a friend, Christoph Lopar. As I understood, I got a text message from Lindsay last night saying she'd been tear gassed. She's on the phone now to talk about it.
Hi, thank you for being with us, Lindsay. Tell us what your experience was like there in Oakland last night.
The raid on the Occupy Oakland was actually two nights ago. And last night, we marched in response to the brutality of the raid the night before that. And last night ended up being just as brutal. There was a lot of, they used flash grenades, flash bombs, and tear gas, and it was a very peaceful march. We were trying to take back Frank Ogawa Plaza, which is where the occupation has been for the past 2 weeks.
So you're suggesting that the police used tear gas on American citizens and flash bombs on American citizens. So how many folks were out there marching with you last night?
I think we had up to 2,000 at one point.
The numbers continually grew over the course of the night, actually, which is pretty surprising. So we started out at about 1,000, and by the end of the night, by the middle of the night, there were at least 2,000.
Some reports say that sound cannons were used as well. Is that the case?
They have the sound cannon out, but they were using it for making announcements and dispersal orders. They weren't using it in its sound cannon capacity. What they did use a lot of is tear gas. They used flashbangs. They used rubber bullets. And we have one person here, I don't know if people have heard about this yet out there, but we have a veteran who from a group, Iraq Veterans Against the War. He was shot in the head with a tear gas canister, we think, and he's currently in the hospital in critical condition with a fractured skull.
Wow. It's strange, these tactics, but to me it says that that this movement, Occupy Wall Street, has spoken or is speaking to the elite. And despite the fact that President Obama wants to put a pretty face on it, I think that the effect of this movement, that this movement is actually having an effect. What are you going to do to move forward from Occupy Oakland?
We're going to continue to have our GA meetings every night. We're going to keep meeting, and we're going to continue marching until we can take back the space where we were protesting before at Frank Ogawa Plaza. We're going to continuously reorganize.
And do you think that your comrades or your fellows will stand with you in the face of this kind of police brutality?
What we've seen is that every time we get attacked, the next day we have 10 times as many people in the streets as we had when we were attacked. So the community is speaking out loud and clear in support of this. And really, if you look at the strategy that the police have had everywhere in trying to dismantle the occupations, they've always tried to deny us space. They always try to deny us a physical space. But what they haven't and what they can't deny us is our ability to connect with other people. And so we just call the reconvergences for places elsewhere. You know, if they shut down downtown Oakland like they did to us, we call the convergence for a space a couple of blocks away. And we can continue to do that forever. And we will continue to do that forever. And as long as we can hold our meetings and gather, then we're going to be able to continue going forward.
After the raid 2 nights ago, we met last night in front of the public library, and we were told by the librarians that the police had called and asked them to close the library and shut it down so that we couldn't gather there, and the librarian said no.
That's really cool. Do you guys know why this turn happened in Oakland? The initial sense that we had out here was that maybe there was more political support for Occupy Oakland, or I don't know if that's true, but do you know why it took that turn in the last couple nights? What was there a trigger, or?
Well, it seems to me that the raids are happening all over the place right now. It was more brutal in Oakland because perhaps the police are kind of notorious for being more brutal in Oakland. But I think there's a more organized, orchestrated raid system going on right now in the country, because of how patterned it looks to me right now.
We're watching our unfold too.
I think that's a good lead in to know. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I don't know if people don't know this about Oakland, but in Oakland at the time of the raid, the mayor actually left town, so the mayor isn't in town right now, and it seems quite deliberate. The police chief stepped down before the raids. There's an acting police chief, and it seems like nobody in the city wants to take responsibility for what's going on right now. So, you know, they will be held responsible, we think, by the city of Oakland for what's going on. But the decision-making around this raid and why it's happening is pretty preposterous. The excuses they've given, which are basically fire code violations. The irony of the whole thing is that the mayor's house is full of fire code and health and safety code violations. There was an article about it in the paper, and they're raiding our encampment.
Speaking of the papers, how have the media portrayed that raid and your march last night and the occupation in general?
Well, I don't think it's a coincidence that the media is trying to accuse these occupations of having sexual assaults and drug use and violence. I think that is very, very careful counter-revolutionary rhetoric against us. And I personally didn't see any of that, and I don't think it's even true. The media is totally unreliable. I would distrust any of these sexual assaults stories that are coming out if they're told to you by the cops. The cops couldn't even own up to tear gassing us at the raid. They tried to say that the occupiers themselves had tear gassed them.
I heard that too.
Yeah, I heard that.
Laughable.
But, you know, and just to talk about media really quickly, last night I was working in the live stream studio, which means I was on a laptop online accessing, watching your guys' live stream feed, which was streaming some news clips, and we were streaming that. So when you talk about bad media portrayal, we're it's good that, you know, we're working with you guys and trying to get our voice out. So it's just like we want people to know that that's always an option, that they should be watching those feeds.
I mean, if I can add too, I mean, the media situation, we know that large segments of the mainstream media are not supportive of this movement, but it's also really heartening because we do get really good stories in there, and it's not consistent coverage. So, you know, half of the coverage will be bad, but every once in a while we'll be surprised by a really nice portrayal in the mainstream media. So, you know, we get the attack pieces, and so everyone's like, the media is against us, and the next day someone's written a piece that's actually really accurate. And so I think people should keep watching for stories like that and you know, rewarding or publicizing those outlets when they actually do cover us well.
Yeah, and this is probably a good point to explain how our media system works as a decentralized network. Essentially, what we've tried to encourage everyone to do when they try to occupy a space is to have functional live video systems using either there's a number of different services you can use. There's livestream.com is the one we generally use. Also, there's quick.com, Q-I-K type applications, and Ustream, just a letter U, Ustream.com as well. And in that way, you can use basically Android phones, iPhones, any phone with the data connection to post clips up and cover these things live. And then, so what we do is on these kind of overnight hours, about, you know, midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., we're watching to see where raids are coming through. And then we patch those over onto our main global station, which is at globalrevolution.tv. And we can bring that to you live, in some cases in split screens, as multiple raids are happening, such as in Chicago or et cetera.
Tony, you told me that I think people were watching the live streams for 15 minutes at a time or something, longer than the average.
Dan could speak to that better than I could.
Yeah, this might not be the time to get into it, but the statistics of who watches the videos, they watch in every country around the world. Just millions of connections have been opened to watch live video, including in China, including in tiny territories in the Pacific Ocean and all of that. So it really is having a global impact. And what's wonderful is to hear people, especially, you know, people that are under pressure out in California, as soon as they hear that they've been patched through on our station, they start, you know, chanting, "The whole world is watching," you know, and that's really been wonderful for me to experience.
And yeah. You were saying, Lindsay, you had a point that you wanted to make?
No, I think that's really great, that sort of accountability, that evidence of what's actually happening. It's so exciting to me, the live streams.
Yeah, we saw that last night, actually, exactly what you described. Someone got on the bullhorn, did a mic check, and announced that they were streaming. And the moment they said that, you know, that chant broke out.
That's good to hear. You know, we had an incident here where the mayor was going to come into the park and raid it, and the citizens of New York showed up en masse to support Occupy Wall Street. They surrounded the park with us and stood there in solidarity. What kind of response have you received from the citizenry there in Oakland?
Well, like we said, it's been really strong. So when the camp was raided, there were probably 300 people there. We had an emergency text system set up that we would activate at the time of the raid. They came at 4:45 in the morning, and the text system that we had brought out probably about 200 people. And the real question was the next day, how many people would show up? And you know, when we met, it was about 500 people. We rallied for an hour. Our numbers doubled. And then we started marching in the streets of Oakland to go back to our camp locations. And by the end of the night, that number had doubled again. We had about 2,000 people when they started tear gassing us. And that's largely why we think they started tear gassing us, is because they had absolutely no way they couldn't arrest that many people. They couldn't contain that many people. And all we were doing was standing there and waiting waiting to take our plaza back, and their response was to tear gas.
Yeah, and they had, it was not just the Oakland police. The police, of course, from
17 different cities. Right.
Unbelievable amount of police.
Yeah, as Victoria was saying, we too have been watching in this city and noticing that there is a pattern, that this is being guided. We don't know from what level, if it's from the White House or from some agency, but it appears that these raids are definitely being conducted in a coordinated manner. Well, thank you guys so much for your report to us this afternoon. We wish you good luck with your occupation out there, and we stand in solidarity with you here in New York at Occupy Wall Street.
Sure do.
Keep your heads up.
And we've actually got, real quick, a march tonight. We're going to be marching in solidarity with you guys at 9, leaving from Liberty Plaza. So, you know, we'll stream that, and, you know, hopefully.
So that's 9 o'clock our time, the 6 o'clock yours.
So, yeah. there is a march from Liberty Square tonight?
Yep, and leaving at 9 our time, Eastern Standard Time. So that's in solidarity with you guys, and, you know, we're watching, and we hope you're watching, too.
The whole world is watching. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Thank you for being with us. And for up next, folks, we're going to hear from you, the New York audience. We're going to take your phone calls. You can call in here at WBAI at 212-209-2900, and you can talk to these occupiers, who, again, are Luke Richardson, Sade Adona. We have Victoria Sobel, Max Hodes, Daniel Levine, Dan Feit, and Faith Logier. Hey, I got that right. And my name is Tony Bates. I'm program director here at WBAI. This is a brand new program. It is called Occupy Wall Street Radio. It will be airing here on WBAI Monday through Friday from 6:30 until 7 p.m. The occupiers are right up the street here. We will do some of it live from the location. We expected rain tonight. We planned to broadcast from the location initially, but word about our equipment, we decided to do it here in the studio. 212-209-2900. If you have questions for the occupiers, 212-209-2950. We're going to take like line 5, I believe, over there, Harold. Line 5, you are on the air with Occupy Wall Street Radio. Go right ahead.
Yeah, how you doing?
We're good.
Good.
Yeah, my name is Ed. I was down there. I think I ran into you. I was the guy with the old WBAI shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, the $30
one. You did run into me down there.
Yeah, the $30 one.
The $30 one, not the $60 one?
No, not the $60 one.
You need the $60 one because it says radio for the 99%.
This ain't the time for it, but I got a bone to pick with you about that, but that's for something else.
We'll get to that later.
Yeah. Basically, I was down there for about a week, and I just had a real question. I mean, in the beginning, when you started, I really felt the vibe, and I really felt like it had the potential to, excuse me, become something great. But as it's dragged on, and I mean dragged on, it's becoming more of protest for protest's sake. I mean, I've participated in some of your working groups and some of your general assemblies, and they just turn into discussion groups. I mean, there are some good things going on, in my opinion, as far as discussions and as far as opening people's eyes to the struggle between classes and what needs to be done. But I think you need to put more of a direction on it. And I've discussed this with people at the park. And it's just, it seems to be getting vague. I mean, you've even got MTV resurrecting the real world format to put a show down there in November in AM New York. They were talking about it. I mean, what is it turning into?
All right, Ed, we will speak to that. Thank you very much for your question.
Well, I think the right to protest is worth protesting for. I think it's important to stay down there, and part of what we're demonstrating is participatory democracy. So it's important to participate.
I actually want to chime in by saying I understand exactly where you're coming from.
Yeah.
I come down every day and ask myself the very same questions. And the interesting thing about that is I ask myself those questions to a population and a movement that looks radically different than it did the day before. And I've been there most every day since day one, and it is a really crucial question about, do we have a direction? I think the answer is yes. We don't understand the direction. No one understands the direction. As I have a profound feeling that this is much larger than all of us, and it's not necessarily our place to question whether or not we have a direction. It's our duty to interact with that direction as we see fit as individuals. And the discussion groups certainly facilitate a better understanding of what those directions might be. But on the ground, it doesn't look like we have a direction because we have scores of directions. Mm-hmm. We have people moving in and out and against each other and with each other all the time. It's chaos and then it's unity and it's chaos and it's unity. And that's part of what makes the energy so vital, and that's what's going to make it last. We don't need to understand what we're doing to do it right.
Victoria, you had a point?
And sometimes Max asks himself that question. Sometimes I ask him that question, and sometimes Max asks me that question. So I feel what you're saying, definitely. And I also, having been there since the first day and having only slept off-site twice, I feel what you're saying about the momentum and the discussion groups and the frustration that accompanies those meetings after meetings, because sometimes I'm in meetings and then the rest of the day I'm reporting back from those meetings. And, you know, what I feel is that in that beginning period, we had a really quick acceleration and that felt really empowering. And right now, what you're describing as dragging and lagging and dragging on is actually, you know, in response to maybe accelerating too fast or trying to find that medium for growth and that kind of equation. But there is no equation. It's like what Max is saying. And directionless or full of directions, it's something that it's being experimented with. So I think a lot of people feel the way you're feeling, and I think that we're actually at a point where we're moving faster.
So I think you're going to see a lot of direction coming in the next few weeks.
Yes.
We seem to be entering a new phase where there is, you know, in the beginning we had a lot of action, and then all of a sudden when we started exploding in popularity, we needed to talk about these things. We needed to talk, create infrastructure. And now we've basically seen, you know, a limit to the amount of people we can get involved in that space. So we're going to see more of a move towards action and more of a call to have more general assemblies in different neighborhoods and, you know, take it back to your own personal space, a space that you actually belong in, and bring these ideals out everywhere in the world and not just in Zuccotti Park.
And Luke brought up the aphorism, you can't dismantle the master's house with the master's tools. That applies as well to our conceptual apparatus. Our ability to think about politics and our ability to think about the direction we're going in has been handed down to us in part by the powers that be that would seek to view this whole thing as directionless, a directionless mishmash that can't accomplish anything. We have to have more faith in ourselves. We have to have more faith in our ability to move and change the world than we have been taught to have. That's why I go back every day.
Excellent. I will also say that my observation has been that in the beginning there was a purity of energy, I like to refer to it as, and folks were all of, not of one mind, but of one purpose. Since then, people have come down and, as I've said to all of you, become drunk with the power of mic check. And people have, I have seen people come who show up just to speechify, who might make the groups take a little bit longer to function because they feel like they have to be heard within their group. When in fact, this group has been working for some time and moving in a direction, new voices, new faces will show up. But the group facilitates that. And that's a part of the new structure that you've been putting into place.
I'd like to say one thing again that makes me so happy about OWS. Like, this is the first time in this nation in decades that people stand up for their rights, and in less than 4 or 5 weeks, actually by the third week, an international movement of people willing to stand up, people are inspired. And I believe we continue to inspire people every day, and through the conversations that occur at Zuccotti, and through, actually, I want to touch upon it, through police actions. We have maintained our peacefulness, our nonviolence, and I think that that civil disobedience that we continually show has, like, won the hearts of people in the face of a police state that we're, like, living under. And right now, I forgot who mentioned the question. Like, oh, a caller said that, oh, everything's kind of stagnant. I don't think that it's stagnant. I think we're growing, and right now there's like thousands of people that come to Zuccotti every day. And we are like providing for them, but there's also movements that are going to be coming in the next like weeks that hopefully will inspire more people to join us, because there's a chant that we have, and it's not just ours, but the people united will never be defeated. People are looking to us like, oh, what's happening next? It's like, yo, we need you to join us. We need you also to stand up for your rights. We're standing up for our rights. We're standing up for your rights. Join us. And let's, like, you know, make what could really happen happen. So we're trying. And all you guys out there looking, saying, hey, hey, you know what? Join us. And it'll happen faster.
Yes, 212-209-2900. I see that what we're going to have to do here is, if we do this way, we'll never get to but one caller per show. So we'll have two people at most address each question. All right, we're going to take line number 7. Line number 7, you are on the air. Go right ahead. What's your question?
Well, I just had a few observations.
We don't have time for a few observations. We have very little time.
Okay, well, I'll be as quick as I could possibly be. I think it's a great movement. I think that one's ability to show solidarity with this movement is sort of a measuring stick to pretty much how hip you are in terms of just knowing what's going on with this problem of corporate power and this concentration of wealth.
Amen.
I have a little bit of a problem with the 99%. I think it's letting the top 10% off the hook a little bit too easily. And I would just like to say that I would really like to see this movement start speaking the language of general strike and tax strike on a daily basis, because, excuse me, there's militant power and there's economic power. And as much as I love poetry and music, I'm a musician myself, all the poetry in the world is not going to stop these people from destroying our planet.
Just keep
so
an ear
we need to start speaking economically in a way that these people have to respond.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments, and we're going to have a couple of responses.
As someone who mostly grew up in Wisconsin, I was really magnetized by the scene that happened in Madison, and that was the occupation of the state capitol. And I think that part of the thing about occupying is that people don't really know what general strikes are in the United States, but an occupation can fill a very similar symbolic role to a general strike. So I think that there's a link between these two ideas, even though a general strike isn't widely understood as an idea in this country.
But thank you for introducing that on the airwaves. This is a great opportunity to start discussing a general strike and what that could possibly mean for the world at large. Also, speaking as someone who was born into the upper 10%.
Orale.
Amen. Thank you very much for saying that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's important, too. I think that's a very important point. I also want to point out that I have indeed heard the talk of general strikes down in that park. So let's go again, and we will keep our answers short as well, as we only have about 7 minutes left. You're listening to WBAI New York. This is Occupy Wall Street Radio, a brand new program on this station. It will be airing normally Monday through Friday from 6:30 to 7 p.m. We're going to go with caller number 8 now, line 8. Thank you very much for your phone call. You're on the air with Occupy Wall Street Radio. Caller, go right ahead. You're on the air. We'll go to the next one. Let's take line number 9. There you go. Caller, you are on the air.
Oh, great. Wait, hi.
Hello.
Hi, this is Fran. A couple of quick comments. I went to the Coalition Against Police Brutality March on Saturday, and it was the biggest march that they have had, and they do this every year, since 9/11 happened. I went today on the healthcare march. It was huge. So what's happening is that this is becoming a staging ground for embarkation on marches for every movement. So every movement now is being beefed up by the fact that they can start with this central location and get so many people who will join in those marches that we didn't have before. So that's a plus, no matter what seems to be lagging or dragging at the site. But I also want to say that, having been part of the occupation of Tompkins Square Park in the late 80s, where homeless people lived in the park and they were supported by the local community and other occupations, that I know the incredible difficulty of keeping this kind of thing together logistically, and you are doing a great job. I am so impressed with the amount of working groups and the amount of stuff that's happening and being dealt with all the time. The last thing I want to say is that this society, being what it is, of course there were incidents of, shall we say, harassment of women by men, because it's just an open scene. Anybody can come into it. But what is great about what's happening in Occupy Wall Street is that a women's caucus has been formed, there's a safe space group, and people are dealing with it and setting up mechanisms to keep people safe.
Indeed. Thank you very much for your comments, friend. We'll go back to line number 3. Caller, you are on the air with Occupy Wall Street Radio. Go right ahead. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Brooklyn. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, let me take the headsets off, because I think this will... hold on.
Okay, you know we're in the radio, right?
Huh?
Go right ahead.
Yeah, okay. I think, you know, the people that you have on, people down there, a lot of people are from out of town. And I want to say this. When you see Al Sharpton come... Run.
Run. That's nothing. Don King was there last night. I have photos.
He is the front man for the corporate structure and for Bloomberg. And if you think I'm lying, go and Google his name into the Village Voice. They've had some excellent articles. He's come down there to derail you people. When you see him, boo. Okay?
Thank you very much for your comments. There are lots of folks down there for photo ops at this point. Luke, you have a comment?
Yeah, you know, we have a lot of one percenters coming down and claiming to be, you know, part of our movement. And that's not saying that they can't contribute. We've just kind of taken a policy that if someone who is not part of the working class wants to contribute, we decide what their contribution is going to be. They don't get to decide. They don't get to say what the money's going for or however it is they do want to contribute. I also feel like a lot of these people feel like they can get a lot more out of us than we have, than they want to give. Maybe they have a book coming out soon. Maybe they have a movie. I think it's very important to remember that this space that we have created is a space for those who have traditionally not had a voice, not for the people who are already privileged enough to have media outlets on that they can always access, to have money to buy advertising or whatever it is that they like, whatever voice it is that they already do have. This is for the people who have been marginalized historically and who are currently marginalized. It's for everyone but them.
Thank you. And Sade?
I always say when they come in, I say, well, spend the night and grab a broom. Like, right. If you really want to help out, yeah. Like, for real, show your solidarity.
Yeah, I met a brother one night there, and he said to me, I showed up, I can't contact any leadership, which is how I feel when I first got there. Everybody's just saying, go here, nobody's helping me. And I said, well, I got ideas, I can help this place. I said, well, we don't need your ideas, we need your willingness. Can you sweep the steps? And right. He said, what? I said, well, you know, that's what we really need, people who are willing to work here. There's 1,500 people here, they all have ideas. What can you do to help? Anyway, I suggested, after he said that I was being negative, I suggested that he go to the GA, start a working group, and he actually did stay there, and he's been very productive, and I'll shout you out, Tim.
I just want to say, as a member of the sanitation committee, sweeping is the least important thing you can do to help us out. Everybody likes to sweep because it's totally easy to do, and it looks like you're working hard, but you're not. I would encourage people who would like to clean to take out trash, sweep, and then mop. Make sure people know the aisles need to stay clear. You know, beautify it as you would a home. You don't stop at sweeping. You just don't.
All right, we'll take our next caller. We have time for one last caller. We will go to line 10 there, or line 9. Caller, you are on the air with Occupy Wall Street Radio. Go right ahead. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I just want to support that guy was talking about, the general strike and the tax strikes. It's the only thing that's going to work. And you must push that vociferously. We need a general strike, and we need a tax strike of all people, and a mortgage strike. I don't know if we could possibly organize that. It'd be a little difficult, but that'll change everything in an instant. If you had a mortgage strike of all over the country... They'd forgive all mortgages by just people just stop paying their mortgages.
Start the conversation.
Yes. I believe that's going to be a time for our last caller. Thank you. We appreciate your suggestions. Sade, you wanted to comment?
A lot of people will come down to the park with all these wonderful, great ideas for strikes or for marches or, you know, et cetera. I say, why don't you start it? You could propose it at GA, and you can come down with your ideas. A Wall Street banker came down with, he wanted to dialogue with a lot of us, but he didn't want to stay in dialogue. He wanted us to put up a whiteboard so he can come back, you know, and write down his ideas, and we dialogue with him like that. But he had the time. He stayed there for about 45 minutes and a discussion bickering about why we should do it. Like, in that 45 minutes, you could have had an open forum or a discussion, which we need to dialogue with you if that's the case. However, like I said, if you have an idea or if you have, like, something that you want to do, that you want to push forward, and all these great things are awesome, we have the platform and evidently the media that comes in there every day and wakes us in our sleep to ask interviews, like, why not take advantage of that and push what you believe in? That's what we're here for, and there are people here who will come and support you from all over the place. So I mean, it's here at not even at disposal, but for your use.
I'd like to share this idea. The system, the machine, it needs the people to operate. If the people were to step back from the machine, if no one were to, I don't know, maybe go to work, if no one were to maybe also not go to work but not sell anything or buy anything, collectively, the machine would stop. So I completely agree with that general strike idea. A full national boycott, I'm down with it. But yes, the machine needs the people to operate. The people have the power.
Dope segue.
All right. We are indeed. You have been listening to the inaugural broadcast of Occupy Wall Street Radio. We feel like we've made history here on WBAI. We are giving these young folks their own voice. They will be here Monday through Friday, beginning tomorrow from 6:30 p.m. until 7 p.m. And we want to thank you for listening to WBAI. We suspended our fundraising for this drive, but I encourage you all to call in and pledge. Yes.
9 p.m. We're going to be marching.
Oh, you guys are going to march tonight,
yes,
at 9 p.m.
In
solidarity with Oakland from Liberty Square to where?
Where are we going?
To City Hall.
Hey.
All right.
How down.
Thank you for
how
tuning
down.
In.
Maybe
this
we'll
is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
It's going someplace and there's no turning back. Chopper coming up over the ridge. Man sleeps by a campfire under the bridge. The shelter line stretching around the corner. Welcome to the new world order. Families sleeping in their car. Searching for the ghost of Tom Jones. He pulls his prayer book out of a sleeping bag. The preacher lights up a bud and takes a drag. He's waiting for the time. Shall we first in the first shot?
The ghost of Tom Jones.
And you are listening to 99.5 WBAI, listener-supported radio. You just heard the Occupy Wall Street radio program. We'll be back again tomorrow night at 6:30. A reminder, you can send your comments and other information to these guys at an email address, ows@wbai.org.
Do you play an instrument? Trumpet, tuba, trombone, flute, drums, you name it. Are you a puppeteer or a puppet maker? Are you a customer? Well, we want you. We invite you to be a part of the Artsy Fartsy Show Walking Float that will march during this year's Village Halloween Parade on Monday, October 31st. If you want to get involved, email artsyfartsy@wbai.org. That's artsyfartsy@wbai.org. We will have one meeting and one rehearsal on October 18th from 7 to 10 p.m. Join WBAI and the Artsy Fartsy Show on Halloween.
Hiya, peeps. I'm Kimberly Massengill. Join me Tuesdays 10 to noon for Thump and Growl. Funk, soul, slowcore, trip-hop, jangle-pop, devil twang, indie rock for grown-ups. Draggy, buzzy jazz nobody'd ever mistake for smooth. Less than flattering songs about Jesus. Old school crooners sporting impressive amounts of hair products. The slow, grindy grooves a junkie stripper would probably dig. Blues by musicians wearing hats of some sort. Songs sung in languages I don't understand. Good covers of bad songs, bad covers of good songs, and loads more. Thump and Growl with Kimberly Massengill. Tuesdays 10 to noon on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City and streaming live at WBAI.org.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
Hi, this is Joe Strummer, and you're listening to WBAI, and it's all mixed up, and it's mixed in, too.
Okay.
It's the 50th anniversary fair event, and one is our full interview on DVD with Glenn. Those two, plus the book, yours for $200, but you got to call right now, 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes a difference. You make WBAI happen, folks. 212-209-2950. If you live in Newark, if you live in Jersey City, if you live in Hoboken, if you live in Manhattan, if you live in Hell's Kitchen or Harlem or Williamsburg, if you live in Prospect Heights, Crown Heights, Brooklyn Heights, if you live in Cambria Heights in Queens or Roslyn Heights in Long Island, if you live in Roslyn, Little Neck, or Great Neck, stick your neck out for WBAI. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. $200. Get the double DVD of Glenn Greenwald and his book, brand new, hot off the press, just released this week, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Laws Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. You'll get one of the first editions. We urge you to call right now, 212-209-2950. Fill these phone lines. If you live in the Oranges in Connecticut, or you live in Blue Point, or Green Point, or if you live in Red Bank, New Jersey, or in Red Hook in Brooklyn, you are not off the hook till you take it off the hook. Go to the phone right now. Even though hooks don't exist anymore in most people's houses or lives, they've got cell phones. We urge you to go to the phone if you appreciate the news hooks that Democracy Now! Deals with. We ask you to call right now, 212-209-2950. $100 contribution, double DVD of Glenn Greenwald. Full interview and the big fair event, including Glenn Greenwald. We're going to play that in a moment. Please make your call, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes the difference. You make it possible for WBAI to happen. Glenn, in your experience, I mean, you're in Brazil usually, but you're doing many interviews. both in independent media and in the corporate media. How important is Pacifica Radio?
Oh, it's absolutely critical. I mean, one of the things, the points that you made is actually a point that Noam Chomsky has made that I think is one of the most significant things he did, which is that the way in which the idea of concision in most established media outlets completely restricts what you can say. I do a lot of television on cable news, in other words. And when you have 20 seconds or a minute, all you can say is what everybody already knows, which is the conventional wisdom. In order to challenge conventional wisdom, you need a lot more time than that. And the compulsion of concision, saying things in 20-second sound bites or 30-second sound bites, absolutely restricts what you can say and therefore what people can hear. To be able to come to a place like this and talk extensively and in a substantive way about the most important issues is absolutely critical to being able to express ideas that aren't usually heard and to be able to hear them as well.
Please call. Make that call. Make it now. Get a copy of Glenn's book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. From the nation's beginnings, the law was to be the great equalizer in American life, the guarantor of a common set of rules for all. But over the past four decades, the principle of equality before the law has been effectively abolished. This is what Glenn Greenwald addresses in his book. Instead, a two-tiered system of justice ensures the country's political and financial classes are virtually immune from prosecution, licensed to act without restraint, while the politically powerless are imprisoned with greater ease and in greater numbers than in any other country in the world. Please call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. Make the call that makes a difference. You make WBAI happen. The book is yours for $150. That's just $12.50 a month. And I don't say that's just, because I know that can be even hard for very many people right now. In Arizona, half the homeowners are underwater. We urge you to go to the phone right now and let us know that you are there, that you're standing up for independent media. Half the homeowners in Arizona are underwater. We ask you to go to the phone. And this in this desert state, underwater. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Speaking of water, starting with Watergate, continuing on through the Iran-Contra scandal and culminating with Obama's shielding of Bush-era officials from prosecution, Glenn Greenwald lays bare the mechanisms that protect the elite from accountability. He shows how the media, both political parties and the courts, have abetted a process that's produced torture, war crimes, domestic spying, financial fraud. We urge you to go to the phone. Fill these phone lines. What did Michael Moore say about Glenn Greenwald? The first thing I do when I turn on the computer in the morning is go to Glenn Greenwald's blogs to see what he said. He is truly one of our greatest writers right now. That's what Michael Moore said. 212-209-2950. Give us a call. Let us know that you're there. Rachel Maddow said Glenn Greenwald is not just the American left's most fearless political commentator. His fearlessness is such that he shifted the expectations for everyone else, too. His rock rib principles and absolute disregard for partisan favor have made U.S. political discourse edgier, more confrontational, much, much better, she said. The number to call, 212-209-2950. He is cogent. He is sharp. He is urgent. No holes barred. Indictment of a profoundly un-American system that sanctions immunity at the top.